The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning. Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am Gina Mastrangeli, a longtime member of this fellowship, and I personally welcome all of you here this morning. Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a caring community that aspires to empower people to grow spiritually, nurture one another, work for justice in the world, and stewardship of the earth. Our building is located in Lower Providence Township near Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And thanks to the wonders of technology, we bring Sunday services to you at home. We celebrate our Sunday morning services hybrid style at our building and online. Whether you are with us in person or virtually online, we welcome you. We welcome you, whoever you are, wherever you are on your spiritual journey. Whatever your background, your gender, identity, expression, or whomever you love. We welcome you into our circle of love and compassion and joy. We extend a special welcome to any visitors this morning. And if you feel comfortable during the moments of joys and concerns, please introduce yourselves. We also invite our newcomers online to sign our online visitor card. The link to this card appears in the chat, which you can fill out anytime during the service. And if requested, we will send you our e-newsletter and provide you with information about our congregation. Newcomers in the sanctuary, please let us know who you are so that we can answer your questions afterwards and introduce you to all our members here. Following the service, both online and in our building, we invite you to our informal fellowship time. This morning, leading the service with me is Lorraine Lee. Lorraine is also a longtime member who has served our fellowship in a number of capacities, too many to enumerate right now. Today's service, Braiding Belief, Morality, and Democracy, centers on our fifth UU principle, which upholds the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. Inspiring and beautiful in theory, yet in practice, democracy is mired in conflict and beset by hostile divisions. As we approach the US election, the descriptions mired in conflict and hostile divisions seem to be understatements. So, how do we uphold our commitment to this noble principle when our beliefs feel threatened, the political stakes are high, and our opposition to us seems to be morally mistaken, cognitively flawed, and maybe even ethically bankrupt? Why should we stay true to our fifth principle? Is it possible to maneuver through the challenges that are inherent in a democracy and constructively further the democratic process? It's not an easy topic to fit into a Sunday morning service, but we will begin the conversation. Let us now open our service by lighting our chalice and peace lamp. Becky and Cam Douglas will lead us.
Today's chalice lighting is Building the Possible by Reverend Scott Taylor. May this flame cast its light toward the coming days, reminding us that the future is not simply a place we are going, but a place we are creating. The path of new possibilities will not be found, but made. A new world is waiting to be built. May our time together light the way. And now, as we light the peace lamp, Please respond with the words shown on the slide. May peace be with us.
Our gathering song this morning is the UU hymn, When Our Heart is in a Holy Place. I invite you to sing along with the UU congregation from Grafton and Upton, Massachusetts. Lyrics are in the video. You're welcome to stand, move, dance, or clap to the music, wherever your mood takes you this morning. Now go to your class and let us sing to them as they do so. The words are on the screen. Mike? Please, would you share the morning's reading with us?
This morning's reading is from Robert B. Talese's books, Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe the Other Side. We typically think of democratic citizenship strictly in terms of its internal manifestations, discussing, debating, canvassing, voting, rallying, demonstrating, and so on. That's part of the problem. Democracy, of course, involves all these activities, but sustaining democracy begins at home. What we owe to the other side is to sustain democracy on our own side. And this requires us to cultivate democracy within ourselves.
Thank you, Mike. Before Lorraine and I embark on our dialogue to explain that idea, Let us sing together our UU hymn, Do You Hear? You are welcome to stand as able. I was once asked, what value do I hold so dear that I would fight and die for it? Democracy. And beneath this one word smolders a volcanic struggle, a struggle to strive towards a noble ideal that clashes with the swamp of day-to-day reality. It's an intellectual struggle, where I seek to understand the forces that sever us into firmly entrenched camps. It's a social struggle, where I'm at a loss as how to reconcile division, divisive behavior patterns in well-intentioned groups. And it's a soul-seeking struggle, where I confront my emotional outbursts, my biases, and my limitations, so that I do not fan injurious flames, but instead walk the steps of positive change. Now, I tell you this up front, because in today's talk, I'm not preaching from the mountaintop, but rather I'm sharing reflections, experiences, readings, and endless conversation, because democracy is a struggle. But luckily, I have support. First, from a book, here it is, that my daughter handed to me last January, Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe the Other Side, by political philosopher Robert B. Talese. Dr. Talese is a professor at Vanderbilt University, and in this little book, he crystallized my seemingly disparate democracy struggles into a well-articulated, logically tight, and cohesive theory. And I also have the support of Lorraine here, whose honest and practical viewpoints make me think harder and ground me when I float up to La La Land. Lorraine, what about you? Why did you agree to join me in this weighty task this morning?
Gina, because we both have strong opinions on many topics, it is inevitable that we do not agree on everything. That is the beauty of our friendship. Each of us is committed to speaking the truth as we see it, and to sharing both our agreements and our differences. It's a critical way of growing emotionally and intellectually.
Let's see what Talese says about democracy, and I quote from his book. Democracy is a self-governing community of political equals. By political equals are citizens who might disagree sharply about politics, but must nonetheless work together as equal partners in the enterprise of collective self-government. Ideally, this would be conducted under the conditions of mutual civility, ideally, with opposing citizens recognizing one another's standing as political equals.
Some years ago, I served on the National Jane Addams Peace Association Board. This was the educational arm of WILPF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Many of you are members of that group. Unbeknownst to me, the board had a strong tradition of coming to consensus on issues. In other words, each issue was discussed until a decision all could agree to was reached. Not aware that this was the case, I voted nay on a topic under discussion.
Surprise.
Thinking I would not mind being in the minority and the group would get their way. The topic did not seem earth-shatteringly important to me. I had often been the lone vote on issues and other organizations. Can any of you believe that?
Surprise, surprise.
Much to my surprise, the rest of the group was shaken when they could not reach consensus. They took time to explain the coming to consensus issue to me. Needless to say, to keep the peace, I quickly capitulated to the majority position. The retelling here makes me much more aware of the need to hear all points of view and to respect the importance of honoring them. It also points out that democracy operates in more than one way.
Well, that's one of the reasons I like talking with you, Lorraine. You bring up ideas that maybe other people have not thought about or are afraid to speak. I feel that different ideas help me refine my own thinking. But as I refine and clarify my ideas, I find more arguments that support my viewpoints. Then I become more passionate and ever more determined that my political stances win. I canvass, donate money, write letters, march in public protest, and stand at the polls. And as I become more involved, my passions escalate. I get more furious with the other side. I rant, rave, clench my jaw. Thank you. I just put that in there. And nasty thoughts about my opponents creep into my head. But I really don't feel too good about that. Years of Sunday school lessons on the golden rule and my mother's ghost whisper to my conscience, is that how you treat other people? Besides, in the ranks of my opponents, I have beloved family and friends. I know their lives and their challenges. And I feel that I owe them the respect of human dignity. Besides, this is supposed to be a democracy, and that means their voice counts as much as mine or anyone else's. Yet, when I feel passionate about an issue, it's really hard to be objective.
This is what Talese sums up as the Democrats' dilemma. As citizens in a community of self-governing equals, we have two obligations. Excuse me. First, we are morally obligated to participate in a democracy. At the very least, we must be informed voters and work to implement our version of justice. The second obligation is that in a democracy, we have a responsibility to our fellow citizens, to treat them as equals and to recognize their right to have their say and speak their truth, even if we think that they are totally incorrect. These two kinds of political obligations can conflict. When there are two sides of a political issue, it is natural to think that the other person is on the wrong side of injustice. It then becomes a challenge to respect opponents as political equals. This is the Democrats' dilemma. The obligation to take responsibility for your politics and advance your view of justice seems to be at odds with the obligation to treat your fellow citizens as your political equals. The challenge is to accept the other person's right to express a view that you personally cannot agree with.
Jeez, I see that these two premises cause tensions. But when there's much to lose, treating an opponent as an equal seems like we might be too soft on the opposition, or that we might compromise our vision of a more just world. You know, but sometimes when I'm exploring a political issue, I've had more resistance from my allies. I'll be rethinking an idea which I'll put out for discussion. Like, for example, many years ago, I voiced my concerns about, this is many, many years ago, about abortion to my fellow board members on NOW, National Organization for Women. You know, my concerns were such as a woman who aborted their girl fetuses, or a girl fetus, because she wanted a boy, or who used abortion as birth control. And I continued to explain that despite these misgivings, I still supported abortion rights, because I did not feel it was my right to decide for another woman. The reaction from my fellow board members surprised me. You are against abortion. I said, no, no, no. And then I restated my concerns about abortions in some cases, and that I believe that each woman must decide for herself. But it's like, you are against abortion. And it went round and round. They could not hear what I was saying. They continued with the litany. You are against abortion.
Your fellow NOW members could not see the nuances, and for them, you were for abortion or against abortion. This us-they way of looking at things is quite prevalent in our culture today. On first blush, many topics seem to divide nicely into two sides. But is this really the case? For instance, your example about abortion is like this. At first, one thinks either I'm for it or I'm against it. However, a closer examination of the issues reveals that there are many complex nuances. How do we resolve the question of when life truly begins? Is it at birth? Conception, after 3 months of pregnancy, or something else? But when we are in a us versus them mindset, this question never gets discussed. We build our walls, stick to a simplified version of our opinion, and then each side usually slips into hating and demonizing each other.
This phenomenon that two groups become more entrenched or more extreme is what social scientists call belief polarization. Belief polarization happens within a group of like-minded people. But note, this is different from political polarization when two parties have two distinct platforms. Belief polarization occurs when like-minded people form coalitions and affirm each other's beliefs. We grow more confident in the correctness of our beliefs and more certain of our superiority. The other side baffles us. So let me explain the psychology with something that I've seen happen in book groups. Someone really likes a book and announces that this is one of the best groups ever. Now, if you happen to like the book, you feel good because it reinforces your opinion. And then, if the person with the literature background pipes in, this book should win the Pulitzer Prize, now you are certain that you know good literature. So it's the idea that like-minded people are affirming the correctness of each other's opinions. And in the process, we become more confident of our own. Now, let's move this example to the us-them psychology and explore what could happen next. So now someone in the book says, I hated the book. It was a bunch of facts without a coherent theme. That immediately upsets the equilibrium. Those with like opinions join forces. This, then, each group defends their opinion. And what could be an interesting, thought-provoking discussion devolves into a dispute of likes and not likes. The us-them mentality. Now, though this is a simple, non-serious example, but in more serious, long-standing issues, when differences of opinion split us into an us-them mindset, once we have a them group, research shows that we change. The distance between us and them grows until we cannot see the difference between the radical opposition and the moderates. They seem the same to us. It's like looking down at houses from an airplane. They look the same. It's hard to tell the well-kept up houses with those who would need a little spiffing up. So this distance and disdain for the opposition causes us to embrace distorted images of our opponents.
The more a group hives together, the more alike and conformist the group becomes in all facets of their life. In a hived group, everyone conforms. The car you drive, the food you eat, the clothes you wear, where you shop, vacation, and live is held in common by the group members. Belief becomes identity. The boundaries between the us and them group grow more rigid. Beliefs become more entrenched, dogmatic, and less tolerant of differences. Anyone who threatens the group's harmony is considered a troublemaker. It's the are you with us or against us mindset. Not being welcomed, troublemakers leave. The group becomes even more conformist. We've seen throughout history where churches fracture into smaller churches, each new church becoming more homogeneous. Psychologically, the point is that if a group cannot tolerate differences with the opposition, then the group is not going to support disagreement within. A group where dissent is discouraged and where shared identity is priority grows conditions for a more vocal, forceful person to assume control. In an environment that cultivates a you are with me or against me attitude and a tight, cohesive, conformist identity, democracy implodes.
Wow. Therefore, if we want a healthy democracy, we need disagreement, discord, and conflict, as uncomfortable as that might be. Another psychological phenomena, also well studied, is that once people have cemented beliefs and convictions, they will maintain these beliefs even when faced with new opinions, and with new information. Or maybe all new information is opinion. I don't know. Anyway, they interpret new information so that it fits into their belief system and conforms to their worldview bias. And that's why people interpret the same information differently. You know, have you ever walked out of, did they attend the same talk or read the same book that I read? It's that phenomenon. So this is known as confirmation bias. But the big question is, how do we break free of our natural human tendencies? Intolerances of differences prevents people from working together and grappling with hard problems.
We must take responsibility to counteract our biases that mask our ability to see the world more accurately and to understand another person's humanity. Whenever we take an honest dive inside and face our limitations, it takes courage. Note that this is not about surrendering our beliefs or defecting to the other side. It's about being capable of comprehending and hearing the other side without compromising our beliefs, to be able to understand and to disagree. It's about seeing the world more accurately by making an internal shift out of a cultural belief trap. This is not to agree to disagree. This is recognizing that opposing viewpoints should be considered as fuel for moving forward and developing new perspectives.
Now, I live in a neighborhood with people who span the political and religious spectrums. We party together 3 to 4 times a year. We help each other out. We exchange gifts during the holidays. We really like and care for each other. And my neighborhood reminds me what South Carolina Representative Reverend Raphael Warnick said to Judy Woodruff in an interview. It's hard to hate someone who shovels your sidewalk. Meaningful relationships make it harder to dismiss and dehumanize other people. So by interacting with people who do not share your political values and having fun with them without engaging politics is crucial to escaping this belief polarization trap. So what do you do? Find something common that you share: gardening, pets, sports, whatever.
Moving to Meadowood, as some of you know, I live at Meadowood Retirement Community, and mingling with people who are supporters of both the Republican Party and also the Democratic Party has opened my eyes to the importance of getting to know people as friends before engaging in political discussions. Strangely enough, I have found Republicans at Meadowood to be far more civil on major issues. For example, even though some voted for Trump and did not like Biden, on the day after the last election, the Trump voters wished Biden well. 4 years previous, when Clinton lost to Trump, the Dems at Meadowood were far less gracious. Many already were speaking of the need to impeach and so on. This even before Trump was inaugurated.
Well, we'll stay away from politics, Lorraine. We also need time to get away from the fray, from both allies and opponents, so that we can think and reflect.
I have found watching social media podcasts to be quite enlightening. It is an easy way to check facts. My computer is my friend. Whenever I hear a news story that seems fishy to me, and sometimes even when they don't seem fishy to me, I use the taskbar to find presentations of varying viewpoints so that I can determine what is the truth in many situations. Not all, I might add. This also points out that in some situations, what is perceived as truth by one may not be so by another.
Professor Talese suggests reading historical events that mimic today's situations, or political philosophy theory that introduce new varied perspectives. I prefer fiction, because a story has a power to tap into a truth, as a reader, outside the situation, it's easier to examine a stinging life truth. A fictional story can transport me into another person's life, different from my own, so that I can see and feel as they do. In this way, fiction can offer new insights and expose us to uncomfortable ideas. But furthermore, I need time alone to think, analyze, and reflect without distraction. Swimming. One hard question I ask myself: am I being consistent? And that is another light example. Do I excuse my friends and my political candidates, yet denounce my adversaries and political opponents in comparable situations. For instance, I remember being absolutely furious when the opposite side stole political signs before Election Day. And then when I heard that my side stole opposing political signs, I laughed. And then I stopped myself, gave myself a lecture, and I do that to myself, on not being consistent. So distance from allies and opponents alike can help one to step outside the situation and look at it objectively.
In conclusion, and as a recap, to make democracy work, citizens need to participate. To further justice, citizens form coalitions with like-minded allies to address the opposition whom they see as a problem. But when we form alliances, we are susceptible to belief polarization, exalting our own views while denigrating the opposition. And at its worst, we become more certain that we own the moral high ground and that our opponents are morally flawed, of lesser intellect, and counterproductive to justice. Conformity grows and eventually democracy implodes. Why sustain democracy with our foes, political or within an organization? Because we need them if we are going to sustain democracy with our allies and friends. To thrive, democracy needs disagreements and conflict. To keep disagreement and healthy conflict alive, we must first manage our own us versus them mindset. The task begins within.
This is the time in our service where we take a few moments to briefly share our joys and concerns. While you collect your thoughts, let us listen to a musical creation by Isaac Strader. Then after, our tech guru, Mike McNeil, will give us direction.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close, and we will do that as we typically do, singing Spirit of Life. The words will show up here on a video momentarily.
Thank you.
years ago, and this silence after a talk reminded me years ago when I coordinated a program and everybody spoke, and after everybody spoke, they laughed or clapped or whatever. I got up to speak. There was dead silence afterwards. Finally, 2 weeks later, I got up the courage to ask Margaret Hughes, and she laughed and she says, you know, I thought about that later. She says, you know, you gave us so much to think about that we just sat there thinking. And I hope that was the reaction today rather than just boring you or angering you. So I just had to remind that. So you can tell me later what it really was. Lorraine will now close our service this morning with words from Lao Tzu.
These words are from Lao Tzu, peace in the world. If there is to be peace in the world, there must be peace in the nations. If there is to be peace in the nations, there must be peace in the cities. If there is to be peace in the cities, there must be peace between neighbors. If there is to be peace between neighbors, there must be peace in the home. If there is to be peace in the home, there must be peace in the heart. And now, if I can read this, I'm going to call Becky and Cam to come up and extinguish the chalice, please.
As we extinguish the chalice, we will keep the flame in our heart and mind. We will remember that we are not finished, but rather that our work continues as we carry the light of the chalice into the world.
Thank you, Becky and Cam. We have one last song that would be fun to sing, another hymn from our hymnal, We Would Be One. Please stand as you are able.
Join in singing our hymn of love to pledge ourselves anew to that high cause of greater understanding of who we are and what in us is true. We would be one in living for each other, to show to all a new community. We would be one in building for tomorrow, a nobler world than we have known today. We would be one in searching for that meaning which binds our hearts and points us on our way. As one, we pledge ourselves to greater service with love and justice.